Good morning, family. I love winter. I really do. It's just about my favorite season next to fall, but I am so tired of services getting impacted negatively by this weather. So that's the only thing I don't like about it. Why can't ice and snow just occur Monday through Friday so we don't have to go to work? Oh, well. You know, gender reveal parties seem to be all the rage these days, with creative ideas on how to let partygoers know what this expectant child will be. And one of them going around these days is lasagna that, when you cut into it, either has blue or pink cheese. Yum. Now, of course, before sonograms allowed people to cheat and find out ahead of time, people had creative ways to try and guess the gender of their coming child. At Diane's very first baby shower, her co-workers from the University of Southern California set it up, and she had to choose between one of two chairs. In one chair, they'd hidden a spoon. In another chair, they hid a fork. And based on which chair she picked, spoon being a girl, fork being a boy, that would determine, you know, let us know the gender of the child. I don't remember which chair she picked, but we had a girl. So there you go. Another method we had was when our third child was, coming along, our oldest child, who probably was 4 at the time, asked us what this child was. And we says, we don't know. God knows. She turned to the wall, this was just before bed, and she talked, prayed, and then she turned back and said, God said it's a boy. It's like, okay, God, we really need you to do this and stuff. But she was confused on that too, because on another occasion we asked her, well, do you want a little brother or do you want a little sister? And she said, well, I want another little sister. And we said, why? She said, God, I don't like the one I have. Like, that's not how it works either, honey. We're not turning one in and getting a different one. So you just, I don't know. So anyway, I have a friend whose name is Shay, S-H-A-Y. She got that name because her mother was expecting a boy and had only chosen boys' names. Up pops a girl. Now what does she do? She asks for the phone book. She just starts thumbing through and her eye lits on someone's last name, Shay. She liked it. That's how my friend got her name. I don't know if they have phone books anymore, so I don't know what she'd do in that occasion. Many centuries ago, a husband and wife were expecting their first child, and I'm sure, like all expectant parents, there was a mixture of excitement and anxiousness. An extra layer of anxiousness than normal, for they lived under an oppressive regime that had enslaved their people and from time to time would kill their newborn sons. So, there was this tragic irony with this child. They lived in a nation where just a few generations before, their direct ancestor, Joseph, had been the number two man in charge of the entire kingdom. And now, their 8th great-grandchild to Joseph would be born a slave, owned by that very same state Joseph used to rule. His parents named the boy Hoshea. He saves. Now, we know nothing about the first 35 to 40 years of his life other than that he was an Israelite born of the tribe of Ephraim, according to Numbers 13:8. He was born to an enslaved and oppressed people where the male infants were randomly killed. Can you hear the desperate hope in his parents' voices as they name their at-risk son, he saves? Roughly 40 years later, their nation's deliverer, Moses, arrived with the power of God to set the Israelites free. But again, that deliverance came with a risk to Hoshea's life. He was the firstborn child of his father, Nun, and his mother. Do you realize what that would mean? That meant that during the last plague that God brought upon Egypt, that if Hosea was not in a house where the front door frame had been hastily painted with the blood of a freshly slain lamb, he would die, along with all the other unprotected firstborn in Egypt. So Hosea was born a slave. He spent roughly the first 35 to 40 years of his life as a slave. But on the dreadful morning when all Egypt awoke to find the dead of their firstborn, he, along with the rest of his people, walked out of Egypt a free man, delivered by the power of God. Now what's interesting is the first reference to Hosea that we have in the Bible, in the order of the Bible as we've got it, it comes after Israel had left Egypt. And it doesn't use his birth name, Hosea. It uses the name Moses gave him later, Joshua, which means Yahweh saves, Yahweh being the personal name of God that he revealed to Moses at the burning bush. Now in Hebrew it's Yeshua. We anglicize it as Joshua. To the Greeks, it was Iesu, which we anglicize as Jesus. So Jesus and Joshua shared their first name, their given name. Yahweh saves. Not even a full 2 months after the Israelites left Egypt, shortly before they arrived at Mount Sinai, according to Exodus 19 and 1, they were attacked. Not by the Egyptians, as you and I might expect. They were attacked by their cousins. Esau, the older brother of the Israelites' founding ancestor, Jacob, had a grandson named Amalek. Amalek's descendants became a nomadic group living in southern Canaan in the Sinai Peninsula. And without provocation, the Amalekites attacked the stragglers in the Israelite columns. Here's how Moses described that attack about 40 years later in Deuteronomy 25, 17 through 18. Remember what the Amalekites did to you along the way when you came up out of Egypt. When you were weary and worn out, they met you on your journey and cut off all who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God. Moses went on to say that there would come a time when God would tell them to wipe them out. It's interesting that the person that Moses turned to deal with the Amalekite attack was Joshua. Exodus 17, beginning in verse 8. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Now again, this is the first time in the order of the Bible that we have it that we encounter Joshua. We never really know anything about his life before this moment, other than he was an Israelite living in Egypt, born into the tribe of Ephraim. His father's name was Nun. He was given the birth name of Hosea, and he was a slave. Now keep in mind that when this attack took place, the Israelites had not been a free people for more than about 6 weeks. It's doubtful that the Egyptians trained their Hebrew slaves in warfare. That'd be just stupid. So as far as we know, up to this point in his life, Joshua had absolutely no combat experience. He had never commanded troops before. 6 weeks before this, he was a slave. Then Moses turns to him and makes him Israel's very first commanding general. And General Joshua has less than 24 hours to become an expert in logistics and tactics. I can imagine it's scary enough for an individual to face their very first battle. But to be the rookie that's actually in charge of that first battle, that'd be doubly frightening. So where would Joshua find the courage, find the know-how, find the stamina to pull off this victory? Not by relying on himself, because he brought no experience to the table. Where he'd find victory is trusting in God, because Yahweh saves. God gave Israel victory that day, and General Joshua would go on to lead Israel in the conquest of the promised land. Before that, though, Joshua would be given a sneak peek at the land of promise. In Numbers 13, which took place about 2 years after the Israelites left Egypt, they were poised to enter the promised land. And so Moses chose 12 men, one representative from each tribe, to form a scout team and go in and spy out the land. And Joshua was a representative from the tribe of Ephraim. Now, many of you know how that situation unfolded. The 12 spies spent about 5.5 weeks reconnoitering the land. They came back all agreeing that the land itself was good. However, 10 of the spies were spooked by the walled cities and the warlike people who occupied this territory. They were pretty successful, these 10 spies, in convincing the rest of the Israelites to give up on the promised land, turn their backs on Moses as a leader, and go back to Egypt and live as slaves. I mean, that's kind of insane, don't you think? Let's go back to slavery. It'll be better than what's ahead of us. That's pretty weird. I guess they were really scared. Joshua, however, and one of the other spies, Caleb from the tribe of Judah, tried unsuccessfully to persuade the people to trust in God and invade. Numbers, the 14th chapter, beginning in verse 6. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the Israelite people, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, He will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will swallow them up. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them." But the whole assembly talked about throwing rocks at them to kill them. Now Joshua and Caleb, they weren't idiots. They didn't believe that conquering the land of Canaan would be a cakewalk. They knew there would be challenges and obstacles and difficulties. But as one Bible student observed, the other 10 spies tended to view God through the distorted lens of the difficulties they would face, whereas Joshua and Caleb looked at the difficulties through the lens of what they had experienced already at the hands of God and what they knew about their God, that Yahweh saves. On this day, Joshua also displayed another kind of courage. It's one thing to have enough courage to face down your enemies, as Joshua did with the battle with the Amalekites. But it takes a whole different level of courage to stand up to your friends and family and defend an unpopular position. 10 of the men Joshua had just spent a stressful 40 days all together hiding under the noses of their enemies while scouting out the land, 10 of Joshua's 12-member band of brothers took a position that was diametrically opposed to that of Joshua and Caleb. And almost all of the Israelites sided with those other ten. So what do? Go with the popular view? Go with what your friends are saying? Go with what the majority of your people are saying? Again, it takes a whole different level of courage to stand up to your friends and family. Joshua and Caleb would not give in to the peer pressure and change their views. There is another challenge Joshua faced starting that day that I think a person can only survive through reliance on God. Joshua had walked the length and the breadth of the promised land. He had even brought back an edible souvenir of the land's goodness, a huge cluster of grapes, though I suspect that after 40 days they were more on the end of raisin than they were grapes. But Joshua was so close to the promised land, he could taste it. And God said, no. No. I'm not giving you this land today. Because Israel rebelled against God that day, He condemned them to wander in the wilderness for another 40 years, 1 year for each day they'd spied out the land, until the majority of that generation had died off. Now He would let Joshua and Caleb eventually live in the promised land, but not until their peer group was dead. Now think about that. Put yourself in Joshua's sandals. You stood up for God. You were in the right. But because the majority wouldn't listen to you, but instead listen to the negative voices, the naysayers, you are going to have to experience the same punishment as everybody else. That's not fair. I'm one of those who hated it in school when recess was canceled for everybody because of one or two jerks in the classroom. I always thought, why don't you just send them to the principal's office and let us go out and play? Of course, there was occasion when I might have been one of the jerks that spoiled it for everybody, but I can't remember. It was too far back. I never thought that was fair, and I'm looking at this and thinking, this isn't fair. Joshua and Caleb did right. They told the truth. They stood up for God. Let the rest of Israel wander in the wilderness for 40 years, but how about letting these two guys and their family set up shop some remote valley or something already in there? Just not the way it was going to go. If you think about it, how could Joshua have been a genuine leader of his people if he abandoned them when they didn't agree with him? If he walked off whenever they made a bad decision? Is that leadership? You know, if he hadn't stuck it out, if he had written them off right then and there, he could not have been around to finally lead them to victory in the promised land 40 years later. They were his people. He loved them. If they were stuck out here, he was going to be stuck out there with them. And he's got 40 years to try and get them back to his point of view. But I wonder, as Joshua trudged around that barren wilderness year after year, if he had other battles. I'm talking about internal battles with bitterness and resentment at what the faithfulness or faithlessness of the people around him had cost him. I mean, come on. He was a human being, wasn't he? He'd been in the promised land. This close to moving in there. And all these boneheads around him screwed it up for everybody. You don't think that there was occasions in those 40 years where they're stuck out there again, still, all this time, when Joshua might have struggled with bitterness, with resentment? Do you suppose he and Caleb ever got together for a men's breakfast, just the two of them, to kind of commiserate and encourage each other and strengthen each other? The question is, how does a person keep from letting those kinds of feelings, the resentment, the bitterness, overwhelm you and eat you up like a cancer? Joshua had to win those internal battles the very same way he won victory over the Amalekites. Not by relying on himself. Not by relying on his own abilities and skills. The only way he could win those battles was by turning to God and relying on Him like His name says, Yahweh saves. Not only from the external battles, but from the internal battles. You and I, we fight these battles too, don't we? Battles with discouragement. Battles with depression. Battles with annoyance and resentment, irritation at your friends and loved ones, the stupid decisions that people in your church family make. Bitterness. Let's be honest. You fight those battles. And if we rely on ourselves to win them, if we rely on our own abilities, our own skill sets, our own knowledge to win them, we set ourselves up to fail. Reliance on God alone is where we find the courage and the strength and the grace to face our battles and be victorious. It is Yahweh who saves, not us. In the weeks ahead, we're going to be studying the life of Joshua, the book of Joshua, Judges, Ruth. I want to encourage you to join me on that journey. But before we get into the book that bears his name, I thought we needed to understand a little bit about the man. Where he came from, what he had to deal with. And the message his very name gives us and reminds us. When it gets hard, when you don't see a light at the end of the tunnel, when you don't know a way out, remember, it's not you. You can't do it. God alone can get you through. If He could get Joshua through those 40 years of frustration and bitterness, He can get you through what you're dealing with. Thank you for listening, family. Appreciate you doing so. Appreciate you coming out today, wearing your skates. And I think afterwards, Jason was going to kind of teach us some hockey out in the lower lot and all. If today you've got a struggle that you just You're tired of handling on your own, which you shouldn't have been anyway. And you want encouragement and strength and support from your brothers and sisters. If you want them to join their prayers to yours, that's one of the reasons we come together. In a moment, we're going to stand, we're going to sing. Roger's going to come up here, and if you have something you want shared with the family, Roger and you will do that. We invite you to make your needs known as we stand and as we sing. Join me.
I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies. Lord, liveth, and blessed be the rock, and blessed God of my salvation. Be exalted, the Lord liveth, and blessed be the rock, and let the God of my salvation be exalted. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be from my enemies. The Lord liveth, and blessed be the rock, and let the God of my salvation be exalted. The Lord liveth, and blessed be the rock, and let the God of my salvation be exalted. I will call upon the Lord.